You're listening to Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, a show whose ostensible folksy charm is belied by our cynical attitudes. Today we're discussing Trey Parker and Matt Stone's Comedy Central show, South Park, which premiered in 1997 and just finished its 28th season. I'm Mark Linsenmeyer, and no kidding, that's my pot pie!
I'm Al Baker, and
I'm Sarah Lynn Brook, and there's much to admire about a show that can be so crass and so smart at the same time.
This is Lawrence Ware, and I'm here to find out who killed Kenny. But I am so taken by the fact that two people on this podcast decided to go with the most lowbrow humor, and then Sarah comes with the most highbrow intellectual analysis. This is a great podcast.
I mean, what sticks with you?
Bit of a tone switch.
I guess this is a good initial question reflecting your concern there, Lawrence, that the best version of this is the initial version. The thing that you fell in love with. I rewatched a good chunk of episode one just now.
The very first episode.
Their very first episode. And in fact, the pre-Comedy Central, the shorts they distributed themselves, these shorts done with love. They're so stupid and so silly, and I still like them after watching them a number of times over the years. And I feel like everything beyond that was bonus. Like, it's amazing that they were able to keep it up, that they have ideas and could even keep this thing going more than a season. It's surprising enough, much less 28 seasons. But still, I don't know that it gets better for me than what it was initially.
That's a really kind of polite way of asking the question, or one polite way of asking the question, is this show still relevant, right? So what's the point of there being 28 seasons of South Park, especially if it arguably was in its purest form in the first season? And, you know, we can talk about the various peaks and troughs of the show as it goes, but there's been a really interesting resurgence in the relevance of South Park over the last year or so, which is one of the reasons why we decided to cover it, and specifically in that they seem to be the first people to really go after Trump in his second term, and in a particularly like South Parkian, juvenile, gross parody kind of way, which is very much their stock in trade, but which no one else notably had really done for a very long time. And there was a real sense before South Park did their opening episode on Trump that people were very, very scared to make fun of him seriously, or what he was doing, mm-hmm. or to try and like go for it, because it was right at the beginning of his second term, was when he was in peak retaliation mode. He was unleashing all, I mean, he still is, but he was unleashing all kinds of retaliatory lawsuits and investigations and so on. But Matt Stone and Trey Parker just absolutely fearlessly did what they do best and made themselves incredibly relevant again by doing it. So it's a really interesting time to talk about them, because a couple of years ago, I would have said there is no point in South Park being on TV anymore. It's not relevant. The humor is Paleolithic by contemporary standards. Like, their sense of humor is at least 20 years out of date. But this last year has proved that I would have been like absolutely wrong. And what's remarkable to me is how, despite the fact that South Park as a show and Matt Stone and Trey Parker's output has definitely varied in quality and in sophistication, there is something incredibly timeless and powerful about their way of working, which makes them a supremely important, unlikely supremely important cultural touchstone. Mm-hmm. And it's very exciting to talk about them in that respect, because it also happens that some of their output is some of my favorite stuff that's ever been made. I can't wait to talk about the original South Park movie, which is where I think, Mark, the true peak of South Park is.
Sure.
Is that where you were introduced to South Park, Al?
No. I was 11 in 1997, so I was exactly the right age for South Park in that I was a few years too young for it. So there was a lot of cultural cachet to be had in school, yes, in being familiar with South Park, because it was definitely too like old and offensive. That first series especially, was so much of it was, you know, absurdist and just gross out humor, and the fact that cartoons were swearing as much as they were, that was where a lot of it was coming from. The song Chocolate Salty Balls was huge in our school. That was where a lot of the appeal was. What's interesting is the show did grow in sophistication at about the same kind of age rate that I did. So by the time in the 8th, 9th, 10th season, that we're getting into their really kind of meaty political satire stuff with the Scientology and Man Bear Pig and whatever else. I was in my early 20s, so I was also ready to receive that kind of messaging, just as much as I was ready to receive the Mr. Hanky jokes in high school.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm almost the same age as Matt Parker and Trey Stone.
You just switched it.
What was that? Oh, I just switched it. Trey Parker, Matt Stone?
Yeah.
Did I just do the wrong?
Yes.
Anyway, those two guys, the creators.
Stone Parker and Matt Trey.
But I was first introduced to South Park at the Spike and Mike's Animation Festival. Do you guys remember those?
Yeah.
Wow. And they came around to San Francisco in... It must have been 96, and I was living, that's when I was living in San Francisco, and I first saw that Christmas episode that was still, it was still made with construction paper, and we were just kind of blown away, and it was cool. It was definitely cool. We felt like we were kind of on the precipice of something, and it was great to see people our age making this crass art and just the best that we had. People that were our own age and our own generation who were satirizing culture. We hadn't really seen that before. And so that first season two mark for me was just, I loved it. I went back and I watched the first episode again that was on Comedy Central. And I remember Mr. Hanky and all of that. And that was all so much fun. And I fell off of it after a while because it became less relevant for me, but I was really pleased to see over seasons 27 and 28 this year, it's just come roaring back. I'm loving that it's this sort of form of resistance. They are masters of poking the bear. They really know how to really hit them where it hurts in a way that even Saturday Night Live can't do. You know, they are really just doing it in a way that I think really hurts this administration, which I deeply, deeply appreciate.
Lawrence, what's your background with the show?
I watched it from the very beginning and I watched every single season.
Wow.
Every year. When they took time off, I was sad about it. Then when it switched over to where I was able to watch because I cut the cord, and when I was able to watch it on Paramount Plus, I then just picked it up on Paramount Plus. And they started changing from doing like series that were multiple episodes, and they started doing these like little short things on Paramount Plus, started noticing that. And so I remember Cred, and I remember how they made fun of Ozempic, and they just made fun of everything, and they were always really smart. It's just that recently they started really kind of focusing in on Donald Trump, although they kind of always kind of poked fun at him, but they made fun of everything. They always made fun of everything. Mm-hmm. And they were always very smart about it. And I loved it. Now, when I was in graduate school, that's when it was at its peak, because that's all of us would get together and talk about the most recent episode. It was always very, very funny. They always had very sharp criticism. But I've been on the South Park train since the beginning. It's funny the way that they characterize certain characters, the crude way that they animate, even though they could do so much better. But the crude way they animate is always funny, even though it's gotten better, but they still kind of stick true to the crude animation. The movie was wonderful. When the Book of Mormon came out, I didn't go to Broadway, but when it traveled, I was able to catch a show of it when it came here. I didn't love their basketball. That didn't hit for me, but I'm a big fan of them, and I'm a big fan of South Park, and I have been for many, many years. So to talk about this is easy because I know it very well.
Just to orient us in time, yeah, Sarah, because I remember going to Mike and Ike's and seeing 1992 Frog Baseball, the first Mike Judge Beavis and Butthead thing.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't remember seeing a South Park thing during that, but Jesus versus Frosty, also 1992. Jesus versus Santa, the more developed one, 1995. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was that long a gap. And then till 1997 before it was actually on TV.
Yeah.
And who knows how long it was in development.
Yeah. I think it was 96 is when I saw it at the animation festival.
Okay.
So, and it was the second one. It was the second iteration. It was the, what was it? Christmas versus...
Jesus versus Santa.
Santa versus Jesus. Yeah.
Was Cannibal before?
93.
Cannibal the Musical is one of my favorite things of theirs, which was a script. They didn't produce it in college, but they wrote it together in college. Of all of Matt Stone and Trey Parker's oeuvre, whenever they veer anywhere near like Broadway musical territory is always when I think they're at their best. Like Trey Parker is a genuinely virtuoso Broadway musical composer. The Book of Mormon is chock full of amazing songs. And you can see it in Cannibal the Musical, which is their first big project, which is incredibly funny and has one of Trey Parker's trademarks, which is these pitch-perfect pastiches. You can't even call them parodies of Broadway musical songs because they're done with such like care and craft, and they do everything that Broadway musical songs are supposed to do in a show. They advance the plot, they tell you about character, but they're also like parodies in that they're also satires of those kinds of songs, and they're also deeply funny in their own right. Nothing Trey Parker has ever done has any kind of right to be as good as it is. I live in awe of him, especially after revisiting some of his work over the last few weeks. Like, there's a guy who won serious awards. I can't remember if it's Golden Globes or Oscars or something. He's nominated for an Oscar for writing Uncle Fucker, and that's incredible.
And yes, South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut was 1999. I didn't remember it being that early, but definitely, like, that felt like a trajectory that they started off with this little handmade thing, and then it just grew and grew until they finally had this giant budget and really took advantage of it, such that the movie just does not disappoint. And yeah, I just rewatched it, and so many of the songs, so well constructed.
Oh, it's amazing.
So memorable. I just want to sing the Kyle's Mom is a Bitch song. That
Kyle's Mom's a Bitch. Let's just not look at something. I mean, the opening song is a perfect like musical opening number. Uncle Fucker, Kyle's Mom's a Bitch. The thing that really got me, there was a joke that I'd never heard. I've seen this movie dozens and dozens of times, and there was a joke that I'd never heard before, and it just made me piss myself laughing. And it's in La Resistance, and it's a bit of lyric that I'd never heard before because it's sitting in the background. But it's Wendy's crush singing, they'll cut your dick in half and feed it to a pig. And though it hurts, you'll laugh and dance a dickless jig. And I haven't been able to stop singing that to myself for days. And it's perfect. I would give my right arm to write a lyric like that. And Trey Parker has it sitting in the background of a medley song. It's amazing. The song that Satan sings is perfect. Just to heap one last bit of praise on Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, they made it, I think, yeah, after two or three seasons of the show. And the context was, like, all of your big TV shows, that was peak kind of six seasons and a movie territory. If you had a successful TV show, you did a movie spin-off. A lot of them weren't very good. South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut is a genuinely fantastic movie. It's incredibly well-constructed, tightly written, blisteringly funny, and as I said, the music's genius. So, these are guys who take advantage of the opportunities that they have, I think, is one important thing to note about them. Like, sometimes their stuff doesn't land as well as others, but they never seem to go half-assed on anything.
Didn't they also do Team America World Police? Wasn't that also them?
I was going to say that. Exactly. That's 2004, so still within the first 10 years of their South Park fame. Mm-hmm. Did they get over their skis at some point after that in terms of, like, is there a Trey Parker thing that we have not heard of because it didn't, like, it seems like Book of Mormon was the next thing after that, which, you know, is still a wild success.
Yeah. I mean, I think all that happened was they had to take a break because there was a period where they were making South Park, which was literally them doing all the writing all the scripts, doing all the voices, and also writing and producing Book of Mormon, and also writing Team America World Police, which they chose to make using Thunderbird-style puppets, which is the most absurdly difficult way to make a movie, but they decided, let's just do that too. So I think they just gave themselves a bit of a breakdown.
They did talk about how hard that was, how labor-intensive that movie was. And not that they don't work hard on South Park. They pump out, you know, an episode in 6 days, I think,
Every single episode in six days.
Like, that's why it's so timely. That's why they can talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's incredibly fast, but they are used to that kind of pacing. And then they would work on, you know, the puppet thing, and they would just be, they could spend an entire day just setting up for one shot. You know, it was so labor intensive and it took so much time. And I think it just about broke them. according to interviews that I've read.
Just since we're running through the production, so Orgasmo, that's 1997, that was pretty forgettable in the fact that I did not remember that I have seen it until just now. However, That's My Bush has never left my consciousness because that was a brilliant little, you know, so they were right on top of making fun of the president. It's just that you could do so in such a nice, goofy way as having this fake sitcom, but then it got canceled because of 9/11 and it was deemed you couldn't rip on Bush in this nice way anymore.
Yeah, and that's I'd kind of forgotten about that, but that's a really good example of something which, even though it didn't get canceled, I remember the first season of that, I didn't think it was the best thing they'd ever done, but they really ran with the premise. They did probably the best version of that gag that was available.
I don't know that sitcom, I was going to say that if parody sitcoms work, I mean, but all these cartoons are essentially parody sitcoms, I guess, but not in the sense of we're going to have a laugh track. Beef House is a recent Tim and Eric thing that seems to have a similar, which was likewise, you know, you probably have not heard of that and it did not make a big splash. You can't really have a long running thing that has a laugh track and has the whole sitcom thing. Like that is just unsustainably painful to watch. Like the real sitcoms are painful enough, but you know, you have to enter that world. And if you're having a parody that is saying, no, don't enter this world, then there's something, you know, that's just a problem with parody things in general with silly movie, with a scary movie and
scary movie,
those kind of things, as we've talked about in our Naked Gun one recently. I must interrupt the proceedings and tell you that this podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. It's an all-in-one website platform. You probably have a business or a business idea, some talent you want to show off, maybe make money off of. Squarespace is a grotesquely easy way to get that all set up on the web. I have many such products. I made my first webpage for my band in 1997. It's still up, marklint.com. It looks absolutely terrible. Any self-respecting new musician, new artist should check out Squarespace. First, you want your website to look good. Squarespace has Blueprint AI, a website builder, to get you a fully custom website in just a few steps. They also have a complete library of premium quality, personalized design recommendations, very easy to modify to show exactly what you want, where you want, and even AI content to write to the content of the page for you. So it's very hard to toot your own horn, to write your bio, to explain your product. Squarespace is going to help with that. And if you want to display audio, you want to display video, you want to sell either of these things, you want to sell physical products, maybe overseas, you want to sell your services, you want to have email campaigns to support all this selling, Squarespace has got all that. And of course, it's got analytics so you can see how everything's working, tutorials, and a help center to make sure you're getting the most out of your Squarespace subscription. Head to squarespace.com/pretty for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code PRETTY to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So why doesn't South Park seem to suffer from that? I mean, it seems like it is a Charlie Brown. It is nostalgia for watching Charlie Brown specials and that animation. And here's what I learned today. And like, they're not afraid to let a joke go, that, you know, they're still not killing Kenny every episode. Like, it was funny, the sort of cartoon reset thing, and let's see how many bizarre ways we could kill him. But then after doing it sort of as far as it could go, and in the movie, really taking it quite far, so that he goes to hell and to heaven and unveils himself. And it's actually Mike Judge's voice I saw doing his one line, you know, unmasked. Yeah, and then they more or less, you know, maybe if they think of a new great way to use that joke again, they'll pull it back. But they let these things go so that there are so many. Yeah, I felt going into this like that I have forgotten more South Park than most people have have learned. And that's just because it's been so long and they've had to shed their skin so many times, even though clearly the same kind of themes do keep coming back when you look over time. I mean, the Blame Canada for Terrence and Phillip thing, I watched an episode this morning called Death, which is in the first season, where the same thing happens, where Kyle's mom gets mad about Terrence and Phillip. And they have this whole thing, like, so, but that doesn't happen more than the couple times, right? You know, we're still not arguing. I don't know. Are these even children anymore? Like that was the initial point, is that, oh, the cuteness of children and these foul things coming out of their mouth. And like, can we even think of them in that way possibly anymore?
I mean, they're not children, but they still are. And that's the funny part. Like, it's just that You know, when you have a real sitcom with real people, the kids grow up, you know. So I remember watching Family Matters when I was younger, and, you know, Steve Urkel got older and he became Stefan and all that kind of crap. And you have to kind of address the fact that they're getting older. With cartoons, you don't have to. That's part of the magic of this show. It's part of the magic of The Simpsons. Like, they can remain forever their age, mm-hmm. and they can continue doing the same hijinks and it still be funny. And I think part of the reason why, because yes, the satire is great, but the satire wouldn't work if it wasn't just funny. It has to just work on a basic level of being funny. And man, like, You Killed Kenny to this day makes me laugh, right? Or, okay. Like, it just works. Like, it's just funny, right? And it has to work on that level. And they got that down. They have that, you know, they have great comic sensibilities, great comic timing. They bring it to the show. And because it works on that level, then they're able to do the satire, right? There's plenty of comics out there in the world trying to make fun of Donald Trump or whatever, and we don't know about them because they're not funny. It's the fact that they are funny, that they work on that basic level of being funny, and then from that point forward, they're able to do whatever they want to do. So for me, what's really interesting and what's really kind of remarkable is that they have been consistently funny for 28 years. You know how hard that is? How hard it is to be funny every single year. Beyond that, I mean, yes, they play with the formula. Yes, they recycle things. Yes, they shed their skin, as Mark says. But they do the same thing really essentially every episode. And that is crazy to me. I don't know how they do it, that they're able to do the exact same thing essentially every episode. And it just works. And Cartman's voice works and his personality works. That's just, it's remarkable that they're able to do this for so long.
Because it's through the lens of kids, they can kind of get away with stuff that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to get away with. And there's this quote on their Wikipedia page. Stone has said that parents who disapprove of South Park for its portrayal of how kids behave are upset because, quote, they have an idyllic vision of what kids are like. And he said, kids don't have any kind of social tact or etiquette because they're complete little raging bastards. And I thought that's exactly how they're portrayed in the show. I love that.
What they've done is developed for themselves a perfect satirical vehicle in South Park. So the fact that the main characters are children is important because they're innocent. So they get to question, so like any kind of mad shit that the rest of South Park is getting up to, they get to, Stan gets to stare blank-faced into the camera and say, what are you doing, Dad? And then Randy explains his crazy scheme and how it all makes sense. And that's how they can do the satire. And then they've got all these other characters that have like cropped up and can fulfill all of these, you know, standard satirical roles. But the show has just become the vehicle for Matt Stone and Trey Parker to do and say whatever they think is worth doing and saying that year. So it does change radically from season to season, depending on what they want to do. Where I fell out with the show, when I stopped watching it, was when they started doing season-long story arcs, just because I didn't feel like it was worth paying that much attention. But even though I fell out with it, I thought it was really interesting and valuable place for the show to go. And there's no reason South Park can't go in that direction. It can go in any number of different directions, tackle any number of different issues. I've only just seen the one-off specials they did when they were on hiatus, or I guess what kind of, it's not really a hiatus if you're still making shows, but their version of a break. And they're great too. And it's a whole different kind of story. And they changed up the entire setting of the show. So like, I don't know why Cartman's living in a hot dog van now, but you know, I'm happy to run with it. But it just goes to show there's nothing, they don't have to even base the show in South Park. They can do literally whatever they want. It's the Matt Stone and Trey Parker show.
I think they being able to take time off, right? Because it is, if you have to keep on a schedule, the advertisers expect it. And it's a brutal schedule, you know, this putting stuff out so quickly. Being able to say, we're going to dictate the length of our seasons. We're going to even just decide, are we ready to release this week? Or are we not ready to release this week? Maybe we can wait until next week. That is crazy. Nobody's ever been able to do that in the history of television, much less animation where,
no, I know.
You know, typically with The Simpsons or whatever, like you got to lock everything down and start working on it, 8 months in advance or something ridiculous like that. The fact that this actually works, and presumably with computer animation, now things are quicker. My sister was actually telling me a friend of hers, like from college, worked on South Park as somebody who would just sync up the mouths for like 10 years. And it was really brutal. I mean, the whole thing sounds like Saturday Night Live in terms of this, you know, this.
Yeah, exactly.
The little documentary, what is it, 6 Days to Air, something like that, that they showed, which was also pretty early on in the run. Yeah, 6 Days to Air from 2011. So, you know, still not before they were ridiculously elderly. You would think that now with the technology that it might be a little less painful. And so they could turn on a dime even more easily.
Yeah, probably. But the position of power that they're in, which you were talking about, Mark, is really important. Is there any other show that has that much power over the network that they air on? They are the only thing keeping Comedy Central afloat.
Well, the Daily Show's still there.
Yeah, but I don't think we'd have a Daily Show if we didn't have South Park.
Well, yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I do not reckon that the ad buy on the Daily Show is all that much to write home about versus South Park. Famously, the reason that, or like the commercial reason at least, well, and the practical reason that they've been able to be so courageous in airing stuff about Trump is that they had the contractual right to do basically whatever they like, and Comedy Central could not stop them. You really have to give them credit for securing those rights in the first place, because a lot of people wouldn't think that it would be something that they would ever need. They presumably gave up a lot of potential money in order to secure those kinds of rights. I mean, that's something you've really got to hand it to them. But I'm just racking my brains thinking, does anybody who has that kind of relationship to a TV network?
I mean, one thing that they have done that I think has helped put them in this position is that they call themselves sort of equal opportunity offenders. Mm-hmm. And so they'll go after anyone, whoever is in, you know, whatever you're not supposed to talk about, whether it's MAGA and the Trump administration, which that's where we were last summer. They were cracking down on free speech. And so they decided to absolutely go after them for that. They also skewer stuff like woke culture when nobody wanted to do that. They skewered Scientology when people were afraid to talk about them. So they've always gone after whatever it is you're not supposed to go after. It is political, but it's not necessarily their politics. I don't even know what their politics are. I've heard that they're possibly libertarians, but who the hell knows? You know, they've absolutely gone after whoever it is that you're not supposed to say anything about, and that's exactly where they go. And I think that's why they're in the position that they're in.
It wasn't super funny, but I remember when they went after Barack Obama and they had him part of like a criminal organization and teamed him up with John McCain. And they were like a part of a
thing. Oh, they were doing a Steven Soderbergh thing, was it? They were Ocean's Elevening with Barack Obama. That was great.
Yeah, exactly. And so and it wasn't super successful, but it was funny that they even tried it. And I think that that's right, Sarah, that the reason why they're able to kind of do what they do and have been able to do it for so long is that they don't take a particular side necessarily. Like they're not only going after Republicans. They're not only going after Democrats. They're going after everyone and everything. Like, so when we became legal, they went after that. Like they just go after whatever they think is funny. And that is part of the reason why I think they have so much longevity is because they are so kind of broad in who they target.
So I remember Richard Dawkins responding to the episode about him by saying, you know, it's too bad that they don't actually have anything to say. because they were just showing him. I mean, the point was the new atheists are kind of just being assholes. Like, just let people have their religion. It lets them relax after a hard day. It is a balm to the suffering that people go through. Why be such a dick as to just, you know, make fun of them for that, or, you know, demand that they be more reasonable. And so that's like, I think that is their politics. I think that was a clear message on that. But the way that they showed that, and I did not rewatch this episode, but I remember very clearly him scissoring Mr. Garrison just in this, you know, that they take a theme and they run with it.
Yeah, I mean, that particular episode, that was great. That particular episode did a couple of things that they do very well and very consistently. The scissoring Mr. Garrison thing, that's about puncturing Richard Dawkins' ego, which is a thing that sorely needed to happen around that point. But yeah, the wider point, oh God, this reminds me of one of my favorite South Park related facts, and I can't believe I hadn't remembered it until now. The wider kind of critique that they're making about science and religion and so on in that episode isn't particularly deep. the thing that really motivates them is unnecessary cruelty or moral hypocrisy or moral cowardice or just what they perceive as idiocy. They're really kind of negative critics in that way. It's not really like coming up with positive solutions isn't their forte. And it's also, honestly, it's where they get really kind of cringy and lame sometimes, where they veer towards doing that. And there is a great example in the Richard Dawkins episode, which is Stan Marsh at the end says, "Can't science be the answer to how and religion be the answer to why?" And now I have an anecdote for you, because when I was in grad school, I was tutoring high school students for philosophy of religion, and they had a textbook, standard textbook, and in the textbook was that quote from South Park, "Religion is the answer to," like phrased as the kind of solution to the riddle of the science versus religion issue, that whole issue, this little quote, but it was unattributed, but I recognized it as being from South Park. So there is a whole generation of British school children have been educated on religious philosophy by an unattributed South Park quote.
That's amazing.
I'm more impressed that high school students are being taught philosophy of religion than anything. I wish something like that would happen in America. Jesus Christ.
Not all high school students.
Okay.
Certainly not me.
One that I did rewatch was Mr. Cartman's brand new...
Mr. Garrison's fancy brand new vagina.
Yes, there you go. I don't know if it's a comment about, and this is way earlier than sort of trans became a really culturally central thing. I don't know if it's a comment about, look how ridiculous trans people are, which is a standard conservative thing right now. They're men who think they're women or vice versa, or whether it was just as good improv does, as good humor does, like taking something and running with it so that it's like, well, this person got a surgery and now thinks that he's a woman, but it really just is cosmetically like a woman. He can't have kids. Well, this person wants to become a taller black person so he can play basketball. So that's Kyle gets the surgery and it turns out that, oh, well, that was just cosmetic too. And his father always wanted to be a dolphin and so gets cosmetic surgery so that he can look like a dolphin. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So like, is this actually making a real commentary about how ridiculous trans people are by thinking that they can deny nature?
I think that's exactly what the show was doing, and I think that was a mistake. And I also think that Matt Stone and Trey Parker also think that that was a mistake, because it's one of the few things that they have publicly walked back. Like, they've never gone so far as to apologize.
Okay.
For anything.
Well, they apologized to Al Gore because I was just looking up articles about that.
They didn't say I'm sorry. They said we were wrong. But their stance on climate change was in the show itself. They've made it clear that they disagree with their former selves on that. They've said publicly that on the Mr. Garrison's Fancy New Vagina story that they were insufficiently aware of the complexity of the issues surrounding what they were talking about. That's as close as you're going to get to an apology from them. Like, I think these two guys are absolutely, I don't think they're cruel. I don't think they're malicious. I don't think they're ignorant. They're certainly not willfully ignorant. But they work very, very quickly, and they come from a very, you know, frat boy, white, college-educated, Gen X kind of humor. And they have been politically incorrect to the point of massive insensitivity, in my view, several times.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I don't think they shouldn't have been allowed to do it, but I don't think it does anyone any harm to acknowledge it. And that's certainly one of those cases. And this is one of the cases where I think they would agree.
Can we run through the issues a little bit? Just gay treatment in general, right? Big gay Al. Like,
yeah, I don't love that.
Politically incorrect, but I feel like compassionate in a certain way. It's definitely trying to have it both ways that you can. I mean, that's the thing with most of it.
Yeah.
Like the handicapped characters.
Yeah.
Like, we want to be able to say that everything is funny. And so we don't want to exclude Timmy from being part of the joke. So gay and handicapped characters, not that I want to say that those are the same thing, but it's a similar, I feel like it's a similar
terrible
approach.
I'm so terrible. I used to laugh so hard at Timmy. I'm so terrible.
But the thing is, it's funny.
It's funny. It was so funny. Timmy!
Here's where I think it's just funny. It's all this is the awful thing. It's all funny on that surface level. It is, they're never wrong, and it is always funny.
I'm so childish. I'm sorry.
But where I think they always get into trouble as satirists, one of the things they often get into trouble doing as satirists is that one of the things that they clearly find funny is stereotypes. So they love to put stereotypes on screen. They don't always do a very good job of making clear that they're making fun of the fact that this is a stereotype rather than just, isn't this stereotypical behavior funny?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're not always clear on that themselves, but that's certainly what's going on in Big Gay Al, because they're like, this is a stereotype. Isn't it funny? Mm-hmm. A lot of their race stuff, Starving Marvin and all that kind of stuff, is in the Book of Mormon as well. Like, clearly what they're doing is saying, this is a joke about how Black people are portrayed in Western media, but they're not really making a joke about that beyond just doing those portrayals and trusting that the audience is going to recognize them as stereotypical and offensive.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that really cuts it.
There's so many layers. You know, you could watch all of their shows on this surface level, and it could be very offensive to a lot of groups of people. And I would include myself sometimes. But when you go deeper beneath the surface, like, I think one of their most famous ones was the With Apologies to Jesse Jackson episode. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that really upset a lot of people. But if you look at that episode, it is really on one level about how white culture centers themselves, yes, even when they're making racist remarks. And that is something that people need. We need to be talking about that. We need to be laughing at that. We need to, you know, we need to stop doing that. And that episode is also can be very, very offensive on other levels too. So that particular episode upset a lot of people, but I think it upset a lot of people for some very good reasons.
Lawrence, did you rewatch that or have any comments on the philosophy of race?
Of
this chef from the very beginning, we're going to have chef in there and have him singing. We have an excuse for him to sing every single episode.
I mean, well, of course it was Isaac Hayes, voicing chef. So that was part of the reason why they had him sing so often. I mean, yes, to be honest, when I first watched the Jesse Jackson episode, I was deeply offended, very offended, because I only watched it on that surface level. I don't like the idea of white creators doing that. Like, that just made me uncomfortable. If it was a Black creator, I'd have been a little bit more forgiving. Because it was white guys from like Colorado or something like that, you know, I didn't like that, you know, and so that bothered me. But after some years, and it took years to get to this point, after some years, I was able to go back to that episode and realize that there was something worthwhile that they were saying beneath the surface, even though I think they dropped the ball on the surface, right? On the surface, it was still offensive. It was still problematic. In the same way, I'm sure that many people who are LGBTQ+ look at certain episodes and say, that's on the surface, not a problem. But beneath the surface, I begin to realize that they were trying to make a more subtle and more nuanced critique of white people in the context of what they were doing. And so I begin to kind of loosen up a little bit, even though that is not my favorite episode. I don't watch it anymore. But I at least was able to see what they were trying to do. And that is the danger that white comedians can run into when they're trying to do comedy about things having to do with Black folks, right?
Yep.
Because there is that surface level that if you go too far, you're going to turn us off immediately, right? Even though the deeper meaning that you're trying to bring to the surface is perfectly fine, or even, you know, laudable and good and worthwhile, that deeper meaning. But if we can't get to that deeper meaning because we're so turned off by that initial feeling of what you're doing, then your entire enterprise is kind of moot. And so, yeah, I think that if they were to go back and do that episode, if they were to kind of tone down some of that offensive stuff that was on the surface and make that deeper point, it would still be funny. It would still be good. But that's an example where they kind of dropped the ball. And the more that I listen to Al, I begin to realize, because, you know, I'm not a member of the LGBTQ+ community. I'm not disabled. And so those things are funny to me. But Al is absolutely right that many individuals were rightly offended by certain kinds of things. And they do go too far in certain places, even though I think that on the deeper reading, they tend to try to make good points, but that surface thing, they can't help themselves from, you know, jumping on the most offensive thing and just kind of bringing it to the surface. And that is sometimes your limitation.
I kind of feel like they're grandfathered in a certain way that, like, oh, new things, right? There's no use versus mention distinction. You can't just use the N-word because you're trying to say it's terrible when people use the N-word. Like, you can't make a show, make a joke where you put that in there because the surface, people aren't going to look beneath the surface level. But they, I feel like they started early enough and they're uncancelable in a certain way. And they are so equal opportunity offenders. Not that you would agree with their politics. I certainly don't agree with their politics quite a lot of the time.
I don't even know their, like, politics, just, if I'm being honest.
Well,
with you.
I think we've said the point that they're making. Yeah. It is libertarian, but it's also...
People reach for libertarian as a way to describe them. I don't think that's actually...
Yeah, it doesn't fit them very well. I don't know.
It doesn't fit them. I think people reach for it because one thing that we know about them is that they care a lot about speech rights. And that they're pretty like extreme about speech rights. And so people say libertarian, but that's about it, right? They're not, you know, free marketeers.
Or ripping on the social safety net specifically. Like, I don't recall, like, let's everybody abuse welfare. Like, that has not been a plot, I don't think.
No, there are a lot of episodes.
In fact, they've done the opposite. You know, we need, like, school counselors. We need them. They're important.
They're moral crusaders. They're not political crusaders.
If I had to guess, I would guess they're probably voting Democratic. I would guess.
Sure. Oh, well, at this point now.
Well certainly,
so let's,
yeah.
Let's talk about Douche and Turd. I think this is a really important early episode, which was that first making fun of the you got to vote. You absolutely have to vote, bringing in Puff Daddy. I believe that. Yeah, that he had a pro-voting campaign at the time.
Rock the vote. Rock the
vote.
Yes,
and so it was like, if you don't vote, I'm going to kill you. Like, so, like, playing into rapper stereotypes, which is not the only time that they've done that.
They offended Kanye West big time doing that one time, yeah.
So initially, Stan was like, I don't want to vote between two horrible options. Why, you know, this whole thing is a joke. I don't want to participate in this. But you have to participate in this. But I only want you to participate in this if you're going to vote for the guy that I want you to vote for. So it's not that I'm just wanting you to vote. I'm wanting you to vote for my guy. So these are all legitimate points, even though I hate this message and I hate that people... you know, for principle reasons or apathy or a combination of these, decide not to vote. And that's why we have fucking Trump, you know, running all together. So I don't think that they would carry that over into these times. But I think at the time of what we now see was a fairly anodyne choice between, I can't really say that. I think Gore was so much better than Bush, but whatever.
I think you're projecting really fucking hard. Pardon my language, Mark, but I have no doubt that they would make exactly the same episode. Like, probably not.
Today? So, I strongly disagree with you.
I don't think that they would equivocate between Trump and whatever wet wipe the Democrats put up to try and run against him next time. But
they're not good options. I mean, they would.
They're not going to sincerely say you have to vote for a Democrat. Are you fucking kidding me? They're not going to sincerely say anything that anyone has to do anything. That's not what they're in the business of doing.
Sure. And I've seen a lot of, you know, explanations of what we're in now. It's not that we all turned fascist, but that we were facing the Douche and Turd thing, that, like, that she was such a bad candidate, you know, not actually vetted, not actually primaried, just sort of got in there because she was the vice president and maybe got into the vice president for reasons that she didn't earn it in terms of the primary, you know, so that we just didn't have good choices. I still liked her. I still voted for her. But sure, I can see where politics, people are coming
but
from.
I'm just for the record, I'm extremely hostile to the idea of compulsory voting, like in any situation. Hmm. So I personally would disagree hugely on that. But I just don't think.
I don't know, man. This might be a discussion we might have to have later on because.
Table this. But the point is that it was an important episode. it said
something really important.
At their hearts, they're contrarians. And so they're just basically saying, why is this? Why should everyone do this thing or think this way? And I think that's what they poke back at.
But I don't think it's contrarianism because that implies they just want to say the opposite of what the popular.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's it either.
Okay.
And
that's
it's not that, but they clearly hate hypocrisy.
Yes.
That's it. Yeah.
And condescension is another big target, right? Liberal condescension in particular, which is another great use of their like main casting conceit, because you have these kids. And so obviously adults can come along and explain these things very condescendingly to children, which don't make sense, but the children have to try and make sense of them. So that's how you know, I don't know what the liberals said. What does Randy say that they all, oh, like Obama, when Obama gets in and everyone's like, Obama's here, so everything's going to be great now. That was a wonderful moment. Do you remember that? About Last Night, that was what it was called. And it was, that was an episode they made in like 2 days, because it was after the Obama's first victory, the election night. And they didn't know which of two episodes they were going to make until they knew who won the election. So they made that one in even fewer days than usual. But that was that everyone in South Park started rioting because Obama had won. So everything was going to be fine now.
Like, if they are equal opportunity offenders, so they basically, they will offend everyone in their audience at some point. Who is their audience? Because these two guys, didn't they sign like a $1.5 billion contract or something? Like, they are making so much money. Who is their audience? How are they able to do this? Who is watching this show?
I think their audience is both everyone and no one simultaneously.
Okay, tell me more.
Like, that is the way that I've always perceived them, because they will offend white people, they will offend black people, they will offend gay people, they will offend disabled people, and then at the same time, they will make all those individuals laugh at the same time, right? And so I think that part of the reason why South Park is as successful as it is that on some level, it causes introspection on the part of the viewer, right? At some point, you're going to be the person that they turn their aim at. At some point, they're going to aim at you as at the viewer. And when that happens, you can either laugh at yourself, or you can say, man, they got a good point, or no, they don't have a good point. And so the way that I've always perceived them is that there have been some episodes where I walked away from the episode and I was fucking pissed off. I was very upset about what I saw, but I came back the next week. And so it's just one of those things where they're trying to offend everyone and they're also trying to enlighten everyone at the same time. And so simultaneously, and I'm sure Al will either agree or disagree, we'll see what he's going to say because he seems to be riled up here. Like, either it's simultaneously everyone and no one at the same time. Al, what say you?
So yeah, kind of. I mean, I agree. It's interesting to look at the point in the other direction. So is that because they will make fun of everybody, but one important facet of that, or one important consequence of that, is that even if they're making fun of you this week, they might be making fun of someone that you hate next week. So you don't feel victimized, I guess, is the point, in the same way that a partisan show would make you feel victimized. A lot of the times when they're making fun of people like me, and gonna hand it to them, they've got a point, and I don't feel like I have to like it or take it or change my life in any way to accommodate Matt Stone's view of my politics. But it's really hard to begrudge them their point of view when they clearly come by it honestly. And I think that's the strength of their coalition of viewers, who I imagine are a mix between, I don't, and in fact, sod it, they're not a mix between anyone. They're basically white men my age who don't have children, I think, are the people who are still watching this show. That's probably, I imagine, their audience.
I will say my father was still a fan of it until just this last year, when he was no longer able to follow it due to his increasing dementia. But well into his 90s, he still really enjoyed the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was raised with juvenile humor. So, like, that's just...
Do you think it's an educated audience? I think no matter where you kind of land on the political spectrum, do you think it's an educated audience?
Oh, I definitely think so, yeah.
Not necessarily smart, but educated. I think but only because I think most people will have started watching this show when they went to college, not because they're clever people necessarily, but because they spent time hanging around people who watch South Park.
You don't think it's it has levels such that
I think
you know anybody, you know, that
absolutely,
that potty humor and making fun of the man who's trying to tell you what to do. It seems very universal, does not require any bit of education whatsoever, and in fact might channel some of the rage that you might have. I don't want to use the word white trash, but as portrayed on there, right? Kenny's family is shown from the very beginning. Is this watched in trailer parks? I would guess so. I would absolutely think so.
Yeah, and Kenny's family also portrayed very sympathetically. Like, it's really easy with South Park to get caught up in thinking about the deeper stuff, because they do a lot of deeper stuff and they do it really well. But it is also a consistently very funny show. There are a lot of just good jokes in every episode. Really easy to have a good time. And that's why they've got a loyal audience, because unlike The Simpsons, and even though they don't have a writer's room full of Harvard grads, they somehow manage to put a few real jokes in every episode.
Maybe we can go around and say, you know, one memory or whatever. I want to pump a recent episode, The Japanese Toilet. I feel like this is the useful kind of politics, that it's making a joke about big toilet paper keeping us down. But like, this was not the only source, but I sort of in the last decade have come to like, yeah, our use of toilet paper instead of bidets as they do in Europe is kind of silly, and more people should consider this as a real option. And so, like, this is such a like a non-political issue, even though it's saying something about American customs, you know, that is anti-conservative. I just feel like this is a very useful function that a show like this can perform.
Put that on my watch list while I'm still working through my Paramount Plus trial.
One of my favorite episodes is Cartman joins NAMBLA.
Oh, wow.
The North American Man Boy Love Association. Episode is just hilarious to me. That's one that I would recommend people watch ASAP.
My favorite episode, which I rewatched and absolutely holds up, is Christian Rock Hard, which is another one with amazing songs in. I want to get on my knees and start pleasing Jesus. I want to feel his salvation all over my face.
That's great.
Oh my gosh, like their ability to make the most offensive but yet brilliant songs is just it's top notch. I don't know how they're able to do it so well.
Just genius, Lawrence.
I was reminded, because I've been loving the last two seasons, and I think these two guys have just they got balls. But Trapped in the Closet, the Scientology episode, completely holds up. And just the fact that they call this whole thing in 2005 a scam was really, really brave. No one was talking about Scientology like that at that time.
I was going to say another really good example of them basically taking a great thing and then having another go at it, because the Book of Mormon is clearly like both of them saying, I mean, we said our piece about Scientology, but we want to say it again and have it just run for 10 years.
Well, and the conclusion of how they dealt with Isaac Hayes's rejection of them for being mean about Scientology, of having, I don't remember the name of the episode, I think it's just Chef Returns or something like that, and it's sort of Star Wars episode 3 ending.
That's another thing that they have not quite apologized for, but expressed regret about, is that.
Yeah, because that's so personal. It's like their friend and their...
Yeah.
Yeah. They're basically saying, you're part of a cult, and that's why we can't deal with you, or why you can't deal with us, and it's very sad, but your cult is as bad as they come. I'm so amazed that in talking here for an hour, we haven't spoiled anything about the latest season. Maybe in our after talk, we can be a little more explicit about the Trump and Satan and stuff a little bit. So yeah, folks can go to patreon.com/prettymuchpop. We would love to have you actually supporting us. It's you support us like for $1 a month, a ridiculously low level, something that means basically nothing for you, but that it, you know, will get you the ad free feed and the after talks for every single episode. So why, come on, just take the 5 minutes to go do that. If you're a loyal listener to the show,
50 cent a month.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it'll let you set up 50 cents a month. I cannot. I'm not even sure of that. Maybe it even rules out a dollar at this point. I have not tried, but that's how I set it up.
Don't you hate ads?
Yeah,
of course you hate ads. Pay $1 a month.
Everyone hates podcast ads. I hate them, and I've done some. I hate them. I hated myself for doing them. But nevertheless, come on. You hate ads. Come on, guys.
Do you skip through the ads on this episode? It's exactly the same number of clicks to just subscribe. It's $1 a month. And then you never skip through the ads again.
And by the way, Isaac Hayes was in a cult.
All right. Thanks, everybody. So long.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.